Welcome to the Punk Rock NBA Podcast.
Yo, what's up, everybody? It's Richie from the Post America Podcast. We're back, and a lot of good feedback on the last episode, and I got a lot of news I'll put in the following episode. But today, I'm really excited because I'm talking to someone I listen to all the time. I got Finn McKinty from Punk Rock NBA. He's a real successful YouTube channel and podcast, among many other things. How you doing, Finn?
Good. How about yourself?
I'm pretty good. Sorry about the screw up. Everybody at home, I was trying to get Finn on, but my tech skills are a little crapped out. But he was gracious enough to still do this, even though I'm half hour late with the whole deal. So sorry about that, bro.
No worries. Sorry for the confusion. I literally just learned that you were in crutch.
Yes, a long time ago. Yep.
I did not know that. Very cool.
You're aware of that band?
Of course.
Okay, good. That's good. Because when I first started listening to you, it was the Straight Edge episode that got me into it. And that's going back easily over a year now, right? That episode?
Yeah, I think maybe 2 years or something like that.
And that's when I became aware of you, and also that you have a history in the scene. And I always love when I pick out people, when they throw little hints out there with you. You know, the hints were, you know, right in your face, and you made it clear, and you gave a little history about yourself in that episode. I thought was really cool too. So knowing that you came up in the scene, and now you have this, you're kind of like the Matt Pinfield of like heavy music. Remember that guy?
A lot of people tell me that. I do remember him. I didn't follow him super closely, but I do remember him.
I didn't either, but he was always on MTV, and he was like the guy for the music that I didn't know about too much. And I was always like, who's the heavy guy for this? Was it Ricky Rackman at the time? But he was more just kind of like a hang around type dude.
Right.
But you came in these current times, and here you are. You're like the Matt Pinfield. You're so knowledgeable about all types of heavy music, even from the hardcore scene up to like straight like death metal.
Just old. That's all.
Yeah. Well, I know the feeling. I'm up there, too. But let me find out. Like, so what was the first, like your first entrance into any sort of heavy music scene? Was it hardcore? And when was it?
It was 1990. I used to think it was 89, but I looked up the video and turns out it's 1990. I saw Suicidal Tendencies on Headbangers Ball, or on MTV News, rather. You know, they had been banned from playing LA for 5 years or whatever because of like violence at their shows. And they played their first show back in LA, and MTV News did this little segment about it. They played in like the parking lot of Tower Records, and they did that's where they shot the video for War Inside My Head, the live video for it. And I didn't know what it was, but I was like, this is fucking cool. Plus, if there's violence involved, you know, when you're a little kid, you think that stuff's cool too. You know, and I was like, if there's violence involved, I don't know who these guys are, but this sounds cool. And then I took my birthday money and I went out and bought Lights, Camera, Revolution. And that was that.
That's a great entrance, because Suicidal had the look, they had the sound. They were musically better than a lot of the other bands that were in their genre, you know? So that's a great entrance.
Could have done a lot worse than that.
Yeah. And you were up in the Northwest at the time. That's where you're born, or?
Yes, sir. Seattle area.
Seattle area. So from there, did you start noticing a local scene, or was it just all stuff from the record stores and stuff like that?
Well, I don't know if you remember Undertow. They were kind of the only bigger band we had here. There were some smaller bands. Well, there was The Accused, of course, who I loved, but you know, not really the kind of hardcore that we're talking about. But there were some smaller local bands, and there was The Accused, there was Forced Entry. If anybody is from the area, they'll remember like Spearhead and Balance of the World and Strain from Vancouver. There were some smaller bands, but Undertow was really the only national band we had back then. Seattle was very, you know, kind of off the radar. I mean, you were touring around then in the 90s and stuff, and you'll remember like a lot of bands just didn't even play Seattle because it's a pain in the ass, like routing wise. The only decent sized city that's close is Portland, which is like 3 hours away. So a lot of bands just never even played. So like, you know, 3 or 4 times a year, we would get like a Victory band coming through or something. And it was a really big deal. So there wasn't really a lot going on locally. And so I was more into kind of national stuff. I discovered Maximum Rock and Roll and Punk Planet and stuff, and kind of got you know, I just wanted to discover everything I possibly could. I would get those and read every fucking review, like look at every ad. I mean, I just like memorized every word of those things and checked out as much stuff as I possibly could. And that was just all I cared about for, you know, most of high school.
Yeah, I do remember Seattle, just like the conversation was kind of like, can we play Seattle? No, you can't play Seattle.
Right, because we'll make $45 and we've got to drive like 14 hours to get there. Yeah,
it was all about the routing. And it wasn't until my other band, Wisdom of Chains, that we would actually just fly out there for like some one-offs, like particularly like Rainfest, if you remember that.
Yep.
But it was always an issue on the East Coast, we think, once we're in California, then we'll head up and we'll hit Seattle. But it's kind of not even an option, especially back then.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. When, you know, if it was a big show, it'd be like 75 people.
And so you delved into the straight edge scene too back then, or did that come later?
I think I found out what straight edge was when I was maybe 14 or something like that. I don't really remember how, maybe from Maximum Rock and Roll or something. I don't really remember, but yeah, I was straight edge as soon as I found out what it was. I never, you know, drank or smoked or did any drugs or something like that until I was much older. Until I was like, you know, in my late 20s or something like that. When I was a kid, you know, my mom was an alcoholic and my dad was a junkie and stuff. And I have a bunch of uncles that went to prison for drug related stuff and blah, blah, blah. So I was like not into drugs and all that stuff, you know, from the jump, basically. So when I found out that there was a thing called straight edge, you know, there were like cool hardcore bands that also thought drugs were as dumb as I did, it was game over. Youth of Today was the band that I really latched onto. And this was maybe 92, 93. So after they had broken up and everything like that. But when I found Youth of Today, I was just like, yes, this is what I was looking for.
That's really cool. And, you know, I'm just noticing more and more people who aren't necessarily straight edge now, but they were straight edge during some real, really important years of their life, like from like, you know, kind of you would say late teens into early adulthood. And I'm starting to think that was, you know, essential to kind of the success of some of these people I'm meeting. Even though they didn't maintain that lifestyle, it sort of kept them on the straight and narrow for a lot of important years, because that's when you get in trouble, you know, late teens, early 20s.
I got in plenty of trouble when I was older, but yeah.
What type of trouble you get into? Any history there we could hear?
Just, you know, I just got, I was just in a bad place emotionally when I was like, I don't know, I got dumped by this girl I was with for like 9 years when I was 29. And that really kind of fucked me up. And that's my fault, not hers. You know, I mean, she had every reason to leave me. And that just really fucked me up. And I spent a couple years just being an idiot, degenerate, and partying and doing too many drugs and stuff like that. Fortunately, I escaped from it without, you know, any kind of criminal record or getting anyone pregnant or anything like that. But it was a gnarly couple years. I was in a bad spot, and I'm glad I made it out in one piece. But yeah, even though it's one of those things where you probably had some of these experiences where you're like, man, I told myself I was never going to be this person and I was never going to do this stuff, but here I am doing this stuff and being this person that I thought I was never going to be. Oops.
Yeah, sure. A lot of people, you know, I guess I would say nearly everyone would go through that kind of realization. And you mentioned the relationship, and I just watched one of your pieces you put out when you're watching a cringe metal TikToks.
Oh yeah, thank you.
And you gave some good relationship advice in that one, I thought, to somebody's kids. You know, we're older men now, so I don't like to tease the kids, but you know, it's so goofy. But then again, I was so goofy. You know, it's
totally, I did all the shit that I made fun of in those, and you know, I hope it comes across when I'm teasing them, I'm doing it playfully out of love. I'm not trying to like humiliate them or anything like that, because like you said, I did every single thing in there that I'm like cringing at. I did all of it.
Yeah, no, not at all. I didn't get that vibe at all. I thought it was funny, and you know, it was cool. Like if the person who made that TikTok happens to be watching, they're smiling. You know, that's it was very cool. Yeah, but the relationship advice was on point. And in your history, I know at some point you move into the Midwest, out to Ohio. What age was that?
I was 18.
So okay, because like, I'm a little more right familiar. I'm a little more familiar with that, like that straight edge scene, that hardcore scene, and that was kind of wild. And it still is wild. Yeah, it still is wild. The Midwest. I don't know what it is exactly, but there's some real animals out there. Yeah. How did you find that experience?
Well, it was definitely I guess a wake up call might be the way to put it. You know, Seattle's a very soft place. It was then, and it still is. And like you said, the hardcore scene out there in Cleveland when I moved there was pretty rough. You know, I would say it's not too different from like Pennsylvania, New Jersey, that kind of set. It's kind of the westernmost end of that scene, I would say, you know? Yeah, I mean, there was like fights at every single show and, you know, yeah, I mean, it was just, I did not know what I was getting myself into. But I'm glad that I did. I mean, it was a horrible experience. I was miserable, but I think I needed it, you know, cause it's just, there's a lot of people there in the hardcore scene that just would not tolerate my bullshit. You know, a lot of it just taught, like I had a big mouth and I moved there and stuff. And I learned quickly, you know, there's a lot of people out there who are not going to tolerate you being a fucking smart ass when you shouldn't be, or you know, if you're going to be a smart ass, you're going to have to back it up, which I was not willing or able to do. So I grew a lot from it. You know, I mean, I remember this didn't happen to me, but I remember Steve from One Life Crew. Some kid was yelling at him about something, you know, whatever, like calling him you're a bad person, blah, blah, blah. And I'm not saying I agree with One Life Crew because I don't. But some kid was confronting him about whatever. And Steve was kind of engaging him in debate for a while. And then you could tell he just sort of ran out of patience. He was like, oh, you don't like what I said? Then fucking fight me. And the kid just kind of looked at him like, well, I mean, I'm not going to do that. Okay, I guess. So, yeah, okay. And Steve was just like, all right, then, and walked away. You know, that's the kind of experience you need when you're a young man, I think in particular young men. You know, you need to get checked like that sometimes. And so I'm ultimately grateful that that kind of thing happened to me.
Yeah. And it's, I just was listening to someone talking about childhood, and it's kind of what you just said goes into that. He was talking about only children and how you have to raise them in a different manner, because without siblings to put them in check, they could develop like a narcissism, you know. And I
was an only child. Yeah. And I thought that I was the center of the world.
Yeah. So there's something to it. So, yeah, you go to a place surrounded by people who are more than willing to put you in check.
Yep.
And that could be like a medication. I like that.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I needed it. Wasn't always fun. And, you know, I'm not saying that those were all great people or what. I'm not defending the way that any of them act necessarily. But for me personally, it was a growth experience.
And I also with the first show that I came across, the Straight Edge show, when you were talking, I sensed maybe some resentment to the scene back then, but maybe I'm wrong. Was I right in that kind of feeling
that I resented it?
Yeah, that maybe there was some sort of, you know, like you just said, there's an affection there, but then there's also some. Maybe I'm wrong, but was there any resentment?
Well, it's complicated. I mean, it's like, you know, these are like family members for us.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And it's like, if someone asks you about your brother, depending on what mood you're in and depending on the last conversation you had with him and stuff, you might be like, ah, my brother's a fucking asshole. Or you might be like, I love my brother. I would die for him. You know what I mean? It goes both ways. So, I mean, you know, with hardcore, especially back then, I guess it's probably the same now. I don't know. I mean, I don't, you know, I don't go to a lot of shows now, so I can't really comment on, and even if I do, I mean, I'm an old man now, so I'm in a different place, but so maybe it's the same now, but at least back then, you know, you're going to run into a lot of dysfunctional people and stuff in hardcore by definition. I mean, you don't start listening to bands called Hatebreed and Terror because like you're a happy, normal person, you know?
Yeah.
And so you're going to encounter a lot of dysfunctional people, and sometimes that you're going to have some bad experiences with them. But I would say that like the straight edge scene is the one that I have the best kind of memories of and like the most favorable impression of. The stuff that really ended up turning me off would be more like crust punk type stuff. And a lot of the like, you know, emo indie type people who ended up just being the most fucking insufferable fucking assholes. You know, I was friends with or around a lot of the, and as you obviously were, friends around a lot of the so-called violent assholes. And in my experience, they were all actually really nice, friendly people. I never had any problems with any of them. It was always the, you know, the fucking clicky emo indie type people that were the biggest assholes to me. And then crust punks are just a fucking disaster. And I just want nothing to do with them. So I would say those are the two kind of groups that there were scenes that, you know, that looking back kind of annoy me the most. The straight edge scene has its flaws, but I don't really have anything bad to say about it. There's some crazy people in the straight edge scene for sure.
Yeah.
And you know, like some of my friends when I lived in Cincinnati in particular, you know, there'd be people that'd be like, oh, I can't believe you're friends with that guy. He broke my friend's nose for no reason. You know, and I'd be like, well, I don't know what to tell you. That sounds like something your friend should talk to him about, you know?
Yeah. When you mentioned the emo and crust punk, luckily all these years I kind of avoided. I don't know much about those scenes at all. But there it does seem to be an element with the emo scene where I see a lot of like creepy girl stuff coming out of there. These kind
that
of
too.
Like, you know, yeah, yep. These guys are just like praying, you know, like. But maybe I'm wrong. Like I said, I don't know much about it. I just liked what I liked for a long time and I went with that. And but like you said, there are some people with these reputations, and but I never felt, you know, I never felt disrespected for no reason. Whenever I had beef, I kind of put myself in those situations. You know what I mean?
Of course.
Yeah.
I mean, I won't name any particular names, but pick the hardcore dude you want that you think of as being like a scary, you know, violent person, whatever. These people are not going to just come up and attack you out of the blue. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. You're just standing there at a show by yourself. They're not going to come up and just decide to ruin your day.
And there were some like that, but they didn't last long. It was almost like a self-policing.
Yeah, because they could fucking go to jail or OD or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, they self
or they just couldn't handle the numbers. Once they do that a little too often, it was just like, oh, you can't be around here anymore.
Yeah, but if someone's been in the scene for 25 years or something like that, like, I'm not saying it makes them an angel, but I think a lot of these stories that people would tell about, I was just sitting there minding my own business, and then all of a sudden they jumped me for no reason. Like, okay, well, you left out the part where, you know, you talked a bunch of shit on that guy for 6 months beforehand or made some sarcastic comment to him or blah, blah, blah. Like, you left that part out.
Exactly. You know, you just you mentioned the name Hatebreed, and one of your videos, you were giving Hatebreed praise because lyrically they are like a really uplifting band, but they don't have that reputation at all, you know?
Right.
But if you did a good one. If anyone didn't hear this, check out Finn's episode where he breaks down Hatebreed, the lyrics, and there's some really deep stuff. And did you ever hear of a guy named Jordan Peterson?
Yeah.
I feel like Jamie from Hatebreed is listening to Jordan Peterson when I read some of his lyrics.
The thing is, you know, Hatebreed predates Jordan Peterson by a long time.
Yes.
But yeah, you're totally right. A lot of similarities there.
A lot of self-accountability you wouldn't expect to hear from a so-called tough guy band, you know?
Exactly.
And you know what? You did me a favor with the episode on Slipknot. And I was, you know, I'm a jerky guy and I like to joke around, but I really always gave Slipknot so much shit. I just didn't get it. They were around at the same time as you know, my heroes bands were. So it's kind of like I didn't see them as pioneers of anything. But
I didn't either.
Yeah, you made me look at them differently in that video about how important they are and to the metal scene. I mean, it's unbelievable. They're really important. And I felt like a sucker after watching that. So I'm going to tell everybody, because everybody heard me clown on Slipknot many times. I knew they could play. I knew they had chops. There was no doubt about that. I just thought once I see the mask, you know, I turned the other way. What do I know? I'm not into that shit.
Yeah, I did too. I mean, everybody did back then. And it's just so interesting to see how the, you know, the sentiment changes of the scene. Like, for example, everybody fucking worships Limp Bizkit now. I mean, can you imagine?
I can't even believe it.
Like nowadays, if you say anything bad about Limp Bizkit, people think you're a clown and a poser. Like, how dare you not recognize one of the most important bands of all time, Limp Bizkit?
Yeah. Yo, and I have younger guys on here. And when I mention, you know, when I say, you know, who are your influence, Slipknot pops up, you know, Limp Bizkit, Linkin Park, Korn.
Those are
the, yeah. Yeah. And I'm just like, what? Like, those were the bands like we avoided like the plague. I mean,
yeah, of course.
Back then. But these are hardcore kids, legit hardcore kids. And that's that, though, those bands were some of their influence. So it's interesting.
I
mean,
I remember when Sick of It All and Cro-Mags would tour with some metal band and get a bunch of shit for it. I don't remember who, like Venom or whatever. I mean, I remember when people said Sick of It All was too metal.
Yeah, me too.
you know, it's just funny. Interesting how, things change.
I saw Sick of It All with Korn.
That's right. I saw that tour. Ago.
Yep. And this
95,
was
95, I think.
Where'd you see it at? In the Midwest?
No, in Seattle.
Okay, I saw it in Asbury Park, New Jersey, and we were like, Korn, what the fuck is that? And I didn't even like their logo, like that little kid-looking logo with the backwards K. But the venue didn't even open up the doors until Korn's last song. But they they were the opening band for Sick of It All. I think it was, the Stone Pony in Asbury Park. And here, you know, they
imagine
were totally
seeing Korn at a place that small.
Yeah. And now I wish I could go back, you know, say, I saw Korn at the Stone Pony, but I really didn't. I saw them basically couple chords and then breaking down a gear. Right. And now they turn into this mega band. And I would have never guessed it. Like, luckily, I'm not.
I had their demo. I they were giving them out at that show.
And what did you honestly think back then of Korn?
I thought it was fucking cool. Because it reminded me of Bloodlet, if you remember that band.
Yes.
Because I mean, nu metal, like, I had no fucking idea what, like, nu metal didn't exist then, you know?
Yeah.
And I had no idea what Korn was. They kind of looked and sounded like Bloodlet, you know, because they're like, they tuned really low and they're kind of groovy and they had dreads and stuff. And I was like, I don't know what the fuck this is, but it's kind of cool.
Yo, you're right. I would never put them in it like compare them to Bloodlet, but it was like that.
Kind of.
Yeah. And even like,
I mean, I thought they were a hardcore band because, or sort of hardcore related or something, because they were Sick of It All. So I kind of gave them the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah. And you know what? Sick of It All should get some props for having them, if they had anything to do with actually putting them on the bill. I don't know. But if I was Sick of It All, I would act like I did at this point.
I would imagine. I wonder why the venue didn't open the doors. Is it because I would imagine a Sick of It All show in 95 at the Stone Pony is probably pretty wild.
Yeah, it was wild, but I have no idea why they did that. But as a person in a band, I've had that done to me before, where the venue was like, start playing now, we're going to open the doors in 10 minutes. And I'm like, what?
Right.
And I'm like, I'm not going to play now to fucking a bunch of security guards. They're like, then you got to cut your set. I'm like, yeah, then I'll play two songs, but I'm not going to play when the doors are closed. What are you, nuts?
Yeah, but it's like a sound check.
Yeah, I don't know why that happened to Korn. I don't know why that happened to us, but that might be like a policy of some venues. I don't know. Maybe in their minds, live music playing as the doors are closed. People I have no idea. It's stupid.
Imagine being the guy that closed the doors for Korn.
I know. What? How? Looking back now, it's so crazy. But even to think Korn was, you know, opening for Sick of It All back then. And even the recent run of shows, I don't know if I'm sure you're aware because you're the Matt Pinfield of this stuff, but you see that run in England with Madball opening for Korn and Limp Bizkit.
No, I actually didn't.
Yeah, maybe it was like 2 years ago now. But okay. Limp Bizkit reached out to Madball to open up that tour. It was Korn and Limp Bizkit doing like 6 or 7 shows in England. Like, you know, what's that big venue in England? The
O2?
Yeah. Like, they're playing places like that. And I thought it was interesting that, you know, Fred Durst was even aware of the, you know, of Madball and brought him out.
Well, he's a smart guy. I mean, you know, he plays the character of whatever, of the red hat backwards, you know, red backwards hat guy, but he's not dumb. He knows what he's doing.
Yeah, definitely. And it's also like there's a link with Madball and Slipknot through the drummer.
That's right. That's right. And he's fucking awesome, man. He does an amazing job of filling Joey Jordison's shoes, which is not an easy job to do.
Yeah, that's Madball always had sick drummers, and that kid is that kid is a badass drummer.
Yeah, and Will Shepler was one of my favorite drummers back then. He has such a cool groovy style.
I always say that. Will Shepler, and then when he, you know, he really proved himself with that one voice Agnostic Front release.
Yeah.
And then that was almost like that was like the birth of a Madball style. A couple key songs in that release showed you what
Madball. His drumming is such an important part of that style that, you know, what people think of as like the New York hardcore style. I think his drumming is such an important part of that, you know, that kind of like groovy, slightly funky kind of style.
Completely agree. And he's a Pennsylvania native. A lot of people don't realize.
Oh, I didn't know that. Where's he from?
He's from Pittsburgh.
Okay.
I'm actually from New Jersey myself, but I moved out here as a young guy. So this is my home now. But
where are you at in PA?
A place called Stroudsburg, PA.
Oh, okay.
It's like the easternmost spot, like right directly west of New York City.
Got it.
So I'll be in New York in like an hour.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a decent location for Philly and New York.
You know, I'm a big fan of Sheetz. Speaking of Pennsylvania, yes. I know you know you might be a Wawa guy. I don't know, but
I love both. And I just did an episode. My last episode was about all things Pennsylvania, and I talked about the beef with Wawa and Sheetz. And Sheetz drips into Ohio more so than Wawa.
Yeah, you know, because they're from Altoona. Yes. My the girl who I was mentioning who dumped me was from Frostburg, Maryland, which is, you know, super close to Altoona. So that's where I learned about Sheetz. We spent a lot of time there for family holidays and stuff like that. So I got on the Sheetz program then. And I will say there's not a lot of things I miss about that part of the country, but Sheetz is one of them. Sheetz is amazing. Yeah.
Sheetz is definitely legit. And that is where we call that the Super Sheetz, the one in Altoona. They make pizza in there. They sell everything.
The MTOs, man, there's nothing like it.
Yeah, it's a great, and there is a rivalry, Wawa versus Sheetz, and all people from PA should just shut up and be happy that they have either of those, because when you're traveling late night anywhere else in the country, good luck.
Nothing. I mean, we got 7-Eleven here. It's okay. It's okay.
It's kind of rough, though. It is kind of rough. We got 7-Elevens here as well.
But it's not, 7-Eleven's okay, but it is nothing like Sheetz or Wawa.
Yeah. In my area, it's predominantly Wawa, but there just has been a Sheetz that popped up, and I like it. I don't hate it. I'm happy to have either, you know.
Would you come to blows over either one of them?
Never. I got back either. They're both.
You got to pick one, man. That's not how this works.
If I pick one, I'd go Wawa, because
this is like prison politics. You got to pick a car, my friend.
If it goes like that, if there's gangs and I got to get down with the W's, then it's going Wu-Tang Wawa all the way. And
all right, so now we know where you stand.
Yeah, and it's a healthier alternative. Sheetz is a little I love those cheese curds at Sheetz, though. They sell these Wisconsin cheese curds. Oh my god,
I like the no bake cookies. What do they call them? Dots.
Yeah. Yeah, they have those. So much good stuff. And Sheetz is superior for soda. Their soda
Fizz City.
Yeah, their soda, I mean, it's unbelievable how many sodas they have ready to go. But Wawa is something about it, and I think it's the soup. It's that corn chowder soup that's unique to them. And this time of year, they have what they call the gobbler bowl, or the sandwich, which is turkey, mashed potatoes, stuffing, and the cranberry sauce all mixed together. It's nice. But yeah, if it breaks down, I'm going Wawa. I got
to do what you got to do, man. I'll just hand you that shank and be like, right, you know you got to put in the work right now. The Sheetz car is over there. You know what you got to do, my man.
Oh, I'm fucking Sheetz up. That's it. You're going down. I'm gonna slice his face. $1.50. Now I'm now talking rap a little bit. I just saw you on No Jumper, Adam 22.
Yeah,
and you know, as I watch his stuff, I'm realizing he as well has roots in the scene, which is super cool.
Yep,
and
you
I like
he had his- Isaac on.
Yes, I saw that, and I just watched one with Toby just today.
Yep.
And it's interesting because he has like knowledge of it, but not like extreme knowledge. So there's still interest, you know.
Right.
He still has. Oh, really? You know, like a hardcore nerd like me, I'd be telling Toby what to say. Tell him about this. Tell him about, you know.
Yeah.
But so it's cool to get the aspect from him, and your interview with him as well was really cool. And that's where you gave more hints about, you know, and the commonality, the hardcore scene.
Hello out there.
Yes, hello out there, everyone. I'm Hal Schwartz.
And I'm Flynn McClain. Together, we host None But the Brave, a podcast dedicated to the music and career of Bruce Springsteen.
Bruce and E Street Band are on tour right now for the first time in 6 years, and we're taking a detailed look at what's happening on stage in our bi-weekly episodes.
We've also been recently joined by some very exciting guests, including rock journalist Warren Zanes and Stephen Hyden, Backstreet's magazine founder Charles Cross, and Barstool's Kirk Menahan.
If you're a diehard Springsteen fan, this is the show for you.
So please subscribe to None But the Brave on your favorite podcasting platform, and we hope to see you further on up the road.
Thank you so much! We'll be seeing you!
Hello, Tom May here, host of Future Friday. I've spent the last 15 years on the road with my band, The Menzingers, where I've met all kinds of wild and fascinating people. So I started a podcast. On Future Friday, I talk to fellow musicians about the moments that made them, their passions outside of music, and the curiosities that tie us all together. I've also talked to the likes of UFO researchers, magicians, soldiers, and documentary filmmakers, and I'm constantly searching for folks that can shape and change our view of the world. You can check out Future Friday wherever you like.
But first, I want to thank DistroKid for sponsoring this episode of the podcast. If you're not familiar, DistroKid is a digital music distribution service that musicians use to put their music into online stores and streaming services. So in plain language, if you have ever wondered how to get your music on iTunes, Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube Music, Amazon, Deezer, Tidal, and many, many more, there's like dozens and dozens of different streaming services, DistroKid is the way to do it. It is super easy. I have used it to put my music on Spotify. It took me maybe 5 minutes to like set it up and upload everything. It's legitimately awesome. I am sincerely a fan of this company and their product. And for those of you who have asked, you can also upload your music to TikTok with DistroKid. And if you want a chance to get featured on DistroKid's Spotify playlists, you can do that by submitting a song through Spotlight and getting your fans to vote for you. You can also use Hyperfollow to get more Spotify followers. You can promote your new release as well as Spotify Canvas. That's where there's the video in the background in the player. And when you share it on Instagram, it shares that video too to make your Spotify release pop. And Spotify Canvas is available to all DistroKid artists. Like I said, as you can probably tell from this, like I am sincerely a fan of DistroKid. DistroKid can do everything I just talked about and so much more. So be sure to sign up with my link, which is in the show notes for this episode, to get 7% off your first year. That link is in the show notes of this episode, or go to distrokid.com/VIP/thepunkrockNBA. And thanks again to DistroKid for sponsoring this episode.
So when was it that you kind of broke off and strayed away from the hardcore scene?
Well, I don't think I ever really did. I mean, here I am talking to you, you know.
True.
So I don't think I broke off from it. It's just like, I don't think I ever really did. I mean, that's like the common, like, oh, that's my friends. And like, I mean, in 1997, I probably listened to 80% hardcore and like went to 3 shows a week if I could. And I don't do that anymore. But I don't personally feel like I turned my back on it or anything like that. Maybe other people think that. But to me, it still feels like part of who I am to me.
Okay, I'm sorry for assuming. The quality you do have that a lot of people in hardcore don't have, and I'll even throw myself in there, is just to be willing to listen to all of these other styles of music and give them credit when credit is due.
Sure.
And I think that's key to the stuff you're putting out, the content you're putting out. And I'm learning a lot about bands that, like I said, I used to avoid. So you just said back, you know, in the day, it'd be 80% you're listening to hardcore. Well, when did the point come where you just became more open-minded and willing to check other things out?
Well, I've always listened to a lot of different stuff. I mean, that like 97, 98 was like, you know, the peak of hardcore for me, I would say. But I mean, since I was a kid, my mom was really into like funk and like blues and jazz and stuff. Like she was really into James Brown and that kind of thing. So that was probably the first kind of music that I was ever exposed to. And then I was into rap before I knew what hardcore was because of UMTV Raps. So I was into that stuff, like all the, you know, all the classic, like late 80s stuff, like EPMD and Eric B and Rakim and Special Ed and, you know, Cool G Rap and all that kind of stuff. And then I discovered hardcore, and that sort of became the focus of my attention for, you know, most of the 90s, but I've always listened to everything. I mean, I would listen to fucking, you know, Madonna and NoFX, you know, and Madball and, you know, Morbid Angel or something on the same tape, even when I was in high school.
So you're just a music lover in general.
Yeah. I like, I mean, it doesn't, like, I don't care what genre something is. If I like it, I like it. It doesn't matter. I don't have any of those like, invisible scripts people have, like, I'm not allowed to like this because it's from this genre or because they dress this way. Like, that's stupid to me. Like, if you don't like something, having said that, I also thought Slipknot's masks were stupid, so I get it. But, you know, again, that's an invisible script. Like, all right, they look dumb. So what?
Yeah, no, I'm with you on that. Because, like, I clown Slipknot, but I love Twisted Sister, so... What the hell?
Exactly.
That? Yeah, like, I don't know.
Is so masks are dumb, but pink fishnet shirts are cool.
Yo, there was a lot of glam. I did dig any glam ballad. I was a sucker for a minute.
Do you remember the band Pretty Boy Floyd by any chance?
I know the name, but I don't know the music.
They were like real late. They came out in like 90 or 91 when glam was basically already kind of dead. Mm-hmm. But they were really good. Poison were great too.
A PA band, Poison.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. From Hershey, right?
Yeah, somewhere more out west than here, but I'm not positive. Like, Pittsburgh tries to claim them, but I don't think...
No. I think I'm pretty sure Brett is from Mechanicsburg.
Okay. And speaking of Hershey, I saw Guns N' Roses out there a few weeks ago.
There you go.
Wow. Listen, Axl started off sounding on point, maybe first four or five. Then his voice, I'll admit, it got shot. It was shot out. But musically, damn. Those suckers can play, man.
Appetite for Destruction. Listen to that shit. Anybody that has never given that album a fair shot, listen to that on headphones. To this day, I would say that is some of the best, like, two guitar kind of arrangement you will ever hear. It's fucking absurd how, like, intricate and nuanced those songs are.
Yeah, that rhythm guitar player, he does not get the credit he deserves.
Shit is brilliant.
Yeah, nobody's writing rhythms like that. It's almost like, wait, what are you going to do with that? Until it's all together, you don't realize.
Exactly.
And you're like,
if you listen to it on your own, it's so like scratchy and weird, and you'd be like, what even is that? But then it comes together.
Yeah.
It's untouchable.
Now, Izzy wasn't playing at the show. They had this other guy that looks kind of like Izzy, the rhythm guitar player, but the guy was on point. He was sick.
Wasn't there a guy in the band named Dizzy or something? Or am I imagining things?
Maybe that's the name of this second, the guy that fills in for Izzy. I don't know. Yeah. Izzy, Dizzy. You know, that's like the real, like, I mean, if you're going to tell an alien what's rock and roll, you're going to show him Appetite for Destruction and Guns N' Roses.
That'd be a good choice.
Yeah, I love that kind of stuff. I was always a sucker for like that band more so than others, but even like the goofy hair bands could get me with a ballad, you know.
You a White Lion kind of guy?
No, not really. But any ballad they do, I would like. I would appreciate it. I don't know why.
How about what is it? The Slaughter, Fly to the Angels.
Yeah, that's a strong song. Like it's just song wise, it's on point. Like, let's say the Beatles did a version of that in Beatle form, we would say it was a great song. You know,
that's a good point. And, you know, the people in those hair bands could fucking play.
Yes, especially on the guitar end. It's like that
some
was just
great drummers too. Like,
yeah,
Bobby Rock from Slaughter, for example, and Nitro.
Bobby
Dude's a
Rock.
Machine.
What a name. Like, in the names, you know, they kind of they knew ahead of time. They took some pages out of, like, you know, the rule books. Oh,
it's like,
check it out.
It's like if Joe Hardcore's name was actually Joe Hardcore, like that's what it said on his birth certificate.
Yo, it should be, though. That guy's like, just, he's obsessed.
It's true.
He's on a mission, Joe Hardcore. He was just out in California just to see some shows. I mean, that's a
Dude,
guy. That
Punishment was sick.
Punishment was sick. And listen, I came up with those guys and they're younger than me, but these guys in Punishment were from a dilapidated shithole city block in Philadelphia, an area called Kensington and Frankfurt.
Oh, that, man, that's where they're from?
Yes. And now it's notoriously junkies and zombies to this day. And back then it was horrible. But they came from there and they played, and if you didn't like them, they didn't give a fuck. And they weren't like the best musicians, but they just came off so hard and vicious.
They were hard as fuck.
Yeah, as little kids. Like, you know, I was seeing them when they were little kids.
I saw them in like 2000, I think, with like Bleeding Through or something weird. And man, they were fucking great.
Yeah. And they just had the vibe, you know, they had that vibe. But they just, the problem was with so many good hardcore bands, they just couldn't keep their asses out of trouble, you know?
Right. And there were so many, like Fury of Five is another band that doesn't get enough credit. People who know.
Yeah.
But a lot of people don't.
Another band that just like, they were music, you know, as musicians, they were better than a lot of the other bands. They forced it upon themselves. I witnessed Fury of Five practice, and the singer was like the coach of the team, and he told them what to do, and he made them go over the set as he just watched.
And when he tells you what to do, you're going to listen. You say, yes, sir.
And they watched, and they made every move they're going to make live. And then he joined them for the second go around in the set as he played, and they all faced the same directions as if they're looking off the stage. And I was just like, man, this shit is kind of crazy. Like, we don't do shit. Like, I was so against being successful. Like, I didn't care about, you know, anything like that, you know. But then I kind of saw Fury. I'm like, oh, man, they think they could make it. Is that possible? You know, and then sure enough, you see some bands getting handpicked from the scene here, going to bigger labels. But Fury was definitely underrated and live undisputed. But I never, when they put out albums, the productions never caught me. They were always kind of like a style of production that was a little too clean or thin for me, you know?
Yeah, I liked it. And they didn't really tour too much outside of the Northeast. And, you know, I mean, back then the ceiling for what a hardcore band could do was so low anyway. I mean, like, Earth Crisis and VOD were like superstars to me, but in hindsight, it's like, oh, they were playing to like 400 people on the best night. Like,
yeah,
that at that time, that seemed like a huge deal. But in hindsight, it's like, man, they were still just grinding it out in a van.
Totally grinding. And they were on top of the scene.
And I'm not putting them down or anything like that. I'm just saying, like, that's how it was. They did the best you possibly could at that time. It's just like,
yeah,
you could only do so much.
Yeah. Why do you think that is? I mean, why do you think that the ceiling for a band that calls themselves hardcore, at least in America, it's so low?
You know, that's a good question, because like you're saying, I know a lot of bands, even to this day, basically make their living in Europe. I don't know why. It's just a cultural thing, I guess. I mean, I'm not surprised, I guess, like Earth Crisis, for example. I think it's amazing that they got as big as they did, given what the nature of their message was, you know, and that they weren't, like, that was their mission, is to like spread that message. They weren't trying to be, you know, celebrities or anything like that, you know? So it's amazing that they did what they did. VOD, you know, that music was really fucking harsh. Like, listen to, especially Imprint, that is really fucking difficult music to listen to.
Yeah.
Like, that, listen to it now and you're still like, God damn it, this is intense.
There's no way a Square is going to appreciate that.
Exactly. I can see how maybe they felt like the first album was a little bit kind of new metal-y. So I can see how, you know, maybe someone would think that was marketable, but then they did Imprint, which was not marketable at all. And that's not putting them down. I think it's an awesome album, but I can see why that sort of would limit their potential, because it's just so fucking harsh. I don't know why, you know, other than the music itself. But then, you know, there's metal stuff that got big, but it's just something back then, you know, there's something about metal, I guess. Well, that was like the peak of nu metal, right? And, you know, those guys, the people in metal, they're not afraid to basically be a spectacle, and hardcore doesn't do that. You know, like, you're not going to wear masks and fucking have the goofy stage names, and like, it's hardcore is less entertaining. It's too real, you know, to be entertaining. And that's why I like it. But I think that's also why it's never going to be as marketable as Slipknot or whatever.
Yeah, that's one thing. The people I work with or my family members, when they say stuff like, "Well, why don't these bands, you know, get big?" or blah, and I just, from what I could see, it's just like they're not willing to really cooperate on a level that they should be willing to cooperate if they wanted to actually give like success a shot. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah,
and,
that too.
That's kind of cool, but it's also stifling, you know.
Well, like, I did a podcast with Ezak, and I talked about this in a little bit because he does have that personality that, you know, he could have had a reality show and he could have been, you know, he's completely. Just such a fucking entertaining guy, you know?
Yeah.
You know, you'd have to ask him why that didn't work out. But, you know, there were some people, and obviously people like, you know, Vinny Stigma and stuff, super like huge entertaining personality. They're out there, but yeah, the stars just never aligned that way, I guess.
Yeah. And 2 years ago, you had a video about Knock Loose, Turnstile, yep. Code Orange, where you said you see big things for hardcore in the future.
Yep.
And 2 years ago, you had Knock Loose on the top of that list. And with the recent, they just put out some new stuff too. And then with the recent success of Turnstile, yep. I mean, you were onto something there, because here with their follow-up releases to that, it's the numbers even higher for them. Not like, you know, numbers in the world of, you know, this, the,
it's
the
not big Travis names. Scott. Yeah.
No, which I just listen. You know, he's all over the internet TV. So I'm like, all right, who the fuck is this guy? That's how out of it I know. I know hundreds of people that are music lovers and no one has ever mentioned his name to me. So I'm like, okay, who is this guy? And I listened to one of his songs. I'm like, all right, I guess it's an average type of song for that type. I don't understand the mass success and popularity of this guy or other people in that genre, to be honest. It's so crazy to me.
With rap, I think the way to think about rap now is that it's not just music. It's more like these people are celebrities who also make music. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Because the appeal of these people is not just their music. It's you're following them because you think this is an interesting person who has like an interesting, oftentimes crazy life. You know, and their music is sort of, you like the music because you like them, not the other way around. You know what I mean?
Yes. And my wife actually said to me, because I was like, you heard of this guy? She's like, yeah, but I don't know his music. I was like, well, why is he so popular? And she was like, oh, I think it's because he's dating a Kardashian.
Yeah.
And I was like,
he has
what?
A kid with Kylo. I think actually maybe they have their second kid, like him and Kylo Jenner.
And I was just like, that's why he's musically successful, because he's dating, and I'm just like, yo, I don't know what's
part of it.
Going on.
Yeah,
it's so crazy, dude. But like, if we go back to Turnstile, who released an album this year, mm-hmm. and I think it's great. And another album I think that's great this year is Quicksand. Those two albums.
I have not actually heard the Quicksand stuff.
I mean, I was never a fan, to be honest. I didn't know much about him. I seen him live. I just didn't pay attention. It wasn't mean enough for my goofy ass. But I checked this one out and I'm just like, damn, this shit is good. Just catchy rock and roll with like great guitar tone and stuff like that. On both of those albums, the guitar tone on the Turnstile. It's just
in hindsight, Walter was always obviously the best musician of that scene by a fucking mile.
Yeah, especially as a writer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Always the best. Like, not even close.
Yeah. And his resume, I only compare his resume to Craig from Sick of It All, because
mm-hmm.
Craig has, and I just had him on before you. I had Craig on.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I wanted to discuss like a certain era in New York hardcore, like the Changing of the Guard era. But
Straight Ahead, man, that is a fucking underrated band.
Yeah, Straight Ahead, it was so dope, and you know he was the guy on. We mentioned it before, Agnostic Front, One Voice, which was like. You know, change the game in that scene, and he was in Youth of Today, and he played.
Was he in NYC Mayhem?
Yes, he was in NYC.
God Mayhem. Damn it, that fucking demo is so good.
Yeah, and you're talking like when he was in that band, he's like a little kid,
like 15 or something.
Yeah, and he's just got a great resume, and he's all, you know, he was also the bass player with the John Joseph version of the Cro-Mags, and he killed it on that because. You know, you could say what you want about Harley, but you know, he could rip the bass, you know?
Yep. Yeah. There's some guys from that kind of era, you know, Sammy has got to be in that conversation too. Yes. Some of those guys are just really fucking good musicians that played in such a huge, you know, range of bands. Richie from, you know, Underdog and Into Another did a lot of shit too. It's interesting how it's actually kind of a small group of people that did so much.
Yeah. And it seems they're all from Queens almost like this.
Yeah,
it's real interesting. One of the things you mentioned, Sammy, I asked Craig about. Now, you know, because he just did a run with Youth of Today again, like a reunion run. The last show they played was like in, I forget what he said, like 87 or something, last time played with them. And he just played with them a few weeks ago. So I said, all right, you played with Sammy, you played with Mackie, you play with Armand all the time. And I made him break down the drum styles. That was pretty interesting.
Petey Hines is another fucking monster drummer from that
era. All right. Yeah. You know your stuff. And I know you're a musician too, right?
Not a great one, but yes.
Now, what is it? I heard you mention with Adam 22 about like a guitar clinic or something like that. Like it's one of the businesses you have.
Oh, yeah. So I have a couple companies that I'm part of. One of them is called Nail the Mix, which is where we teach people how to record and mix music. So the way that works is every month we have a different producer come on and they give you the actual raw multi-tracks to the album. And then at the end of the month, they do a live stream where they show how they did it on the album. And you can kind of compare their work to theirs. So we've had like, I don't know, like Fall Out Boy, Bring Me the Horizon, Meshuggah, Opeth, Gojira, Periphery, I don't know, tons. We've had like 75 bands or something on now. Like the best of the best. So that's one of them. That's the one that's
a brilliant idea. That is brilliant.
It's pretty cool. Really changes how, I mean, because before there's no way for you to know how the sausage was made.
Yeah.
Unless you like knew somebody who worked at a studio or something, there was no way to know. And now, you know, you can see exactly how they did it. There's no secrets anymore. The other one we have is called riffhard.com, which is for metal guitarists. That's, we do that with a guy named John Brown from this band called Monuments. That's kind of one of the founding fathers of the djent scene. And same kind of thing. We have a different guest guitarist come on every month to show how they do their thing. That one's a little bit newer. But this month we have Dan Sugarman from a band called Ice Nine Kills on, who's ridiculous. So if you want to be a shredder, riffhard.com is place to go.
Beautiful. Very cool, man. But what do you play? You play guitar?
Yeah. And drums badly. And I can, I'm a decent mixer. I'm not great, but I'm decent.
I'm just, I've been over the pandemic. I've been trying to learn how to record, but, because we always went to the studio, we would write traditionally, get in a room together, this and that. But when I had that time off, I bought like Cubase and some gear and gave it a shot. Really fun. And it's getting easier and easier.
Yep.
Man, I enjoy it. I got to check that thing out because I'd love to learn some tricks.
I'll send you a login for it.
That's cool. Yeah, I'd love to learn some of those tricks because I'm listening. And some of the bands you mentioned, I don't even know how like these productions are possible. Like some of the drum production on this new stuff, it's like, what the hell?
It's mostly incredible. Fake.
Yeah, totally. But even like fake wise, they know stuff. They know stuff that I obviously don't know.
The drums are the hardest part, I would say, for sure. But now with like, you know, all the drum samples and the drum libraries and stuff. I don't like the style. This is my personal opinion. I don't like that style of like the super modern drums, because to me, they don't actually sound like drums.
Yeah.
Like this, the snare sound on a lot of albums these days, like it doesn't sound like a snare drum, you know?
No, not like 90% that you would be standing next to
it. Exactly. You know? Like if you've ever stood next to a snare drum and you're like, is this what it sounded like to you? The answer is no.
Yeah.
And you listen to like the way drums, like if you've ever been in a room with a band and someone's playing drums, all you hear is cymbals, right?
Yep.
But on records now, and I understand why, but it's like all you hear is this super, super loud, clicky kick drum and a super loud, really sampled snare with hardly any cymbals or rooms. And if people like that, that's cool. But it's distracting to me because it literally just doesn't sound like a drum set, you know?
Yeah. I like the more traditional kind of like, you know, like the last Blood for Blood, like Outlaw Anthem type production, like just sounds like a good, you know, like if you were at a club with a good PA system and a good engineer, this is how it would probably sound with a regular head and no tricks. But
which
yeah,
isn't right for every band, but
no, it's not
definitely like, for like hardcore. My, like to me, the pinnacle of production, I think to this day, like I'm a huge fan of Steve Evitz, who did probably, you know, 80% of the really good sounding 90s hardcore stuff out of Trax East. We've had him on with Dillinger Escape Plan. I love his stuff because it sounds tight and punchy and clean, but it's still real.
Yeah, wow, Tracks East. That was like a fantasy when I was younger to record at that place.
That's right. Yeah. Well, Evitz did his best work. Well, not his best work, but at that time, yeah, he did his best work out of there.
Yeah, I used to always look at the liner notes. Oh, Tracks East again. Those motherfuckers. Yeah. How could I get up there?
That's right.
Yeah, that's dope. That's real cool. You know, a production I like is that Will Putney guy with the Body Count stuff.
Yep. And Knocked Loose. We've had him on a couple times.
Okay, yeah, that guy knows some shit. Like, because the Body Count was like rock and roll enough that I really liked it. You know, with the other bands, he gets what they want, which is kind of like you described with the drums. And it's just like so almost so unnatural that, yeah, I can't really get into it.
But it's what people like, you know.
It is.
I'm an old man. Who the fuck cares what I think?
Yeah, like I'm so far out of it. What the fuck do I know at this point? I like to talk about it, though. And, I was talking to you about Turnstile before. And then I got sidetracked. But so when 2 years ago you made that video, you kind of foresaw big things happening within the scene. Do you think there's a ceiling for Turnstile, or are they going to keep on going?
Well, I mean, they're never going to be able to be a top 10 band, you know, and I don't think they want to be. But I think they'll be able to, you know, keep doing what they're doing as long as they want. There's no reason why they can't. You know, people love them and they keep exceeding expectations with every album. So, you know, are they going to be the next Post Malone? No, but I don't think they want to be.
Yeah, I'm seeing them on these bills that would have a person like Post Malone. And that's really that's surprising. That's cool.
So, yeah, they're not outside of that conversation, which even just that itself is pretty amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. I figure I get the expert opinion from you.
I don't know anything more than you.
Nah, come on. You got your ear to the street, baby. You know what's going on. Me, I go to the local show, and then that's it. It's a couple fights, a couple bands, and I go home.
That's right. It's like, who's on the undercard?
Yeah, like, okay, there's a good fight outside or this new band. I'm going to check out the first couple of seconds of the fight and then come and check two songs from the band.
Yeah,
and
then fight was kind of slow.
Yeah, and then have a pretzel from Wawa afterwards.
There you go. That's the dream. That's why I was having so much fun with hardcore in 97, 98, because I would go to Peabody's in Cleveland. I don't know if you ever played there.
Yes, I love Peabody's.
Yeah, the old Peabody's. We'd go there in the flats and go, if the band was cool, then we'd watch the band. If not, then we'd just stand outside and watch whatever the fuck was happening in the street then, which, you know, at that time there was a lot of wild shit happening, and just, you know, go harass people in the street and whatever, and go to Hooters to get some wings or something. And it was fun.
Yeah, Peabody's was wild. Did you know that one of the security from Peabody's is a WWE wrestler? It goes by the name Raymond Rowe.
I don't follow wrestling too much, but that's cool.
Yeah, I mean, me neither, but he's up there. He's kind of a famous guy. And he promotes straight edge. He's like a straight edge Viking.
Oh.
In WWE, and he was I had him on a show, I think, last year. He was security at Peabody's, so we talked about a lot of that stuff.
That's cool.
Yeah, you never know, but just knowing that for the people at home, that's the kind of animals you got in Cleveland. They end up joining the WWE after doing security for years.
I have a fun story that I will tell for maybe some of the people on this podcast would find this interesting. So back then, I have no idea what the status of this is now. I hope that nobody involved cares anymore. But at the time, there was this like New York Cleveland beef or whatever, and I don't even know all the details. But I remember Madball and Scarhead played Cleveland. Well, this is when Ezek was living in Cleveland.
Mm-hmm.
98.
The balls on him, right? What a guy!
Well, I mean,
he's got beef with Cleveland, and he moves there.
That's how he rolls, and. Think we all know how that beef turned out. So yeah. I think he was justified. But so they played, and I was standing towards the back because, you know, I did not want any part of the dance floor at that show. And because, you know, at the time I was probably 140 pounds or something. And there were two, I think it was Chubby Fresh and Steve were in front of me. Don't quote me on that, but it was two guys from One Life Crew were in front of me kind of watching. And and Ezek called him out on stage, you know, basically like, hey, you know, here we are. Like, what are you going to do about it? And I couldn't hear what they were saying, but I just saw them kind of turn to each other and say something and then just like walk out the back.
Smart move.
That's what I thought. I was like, yeah, that's probably the right thing to do.
Yeah. I'm friends with Chubby. I like Chubby.
He was always cool to me. Yeah, I mean, I don't, you know, he's said a lot of wild shit over the years. I don't endorse any of it, but he was always really nice, really friendly to me. I never had a bad experience with him personally. Steve was always cool to me too.
Yeah. I met Steve a few times, but Chubbs is like a friend, but he can't shut up. He's like very, you know, if he feels like he has to say something, he says it. It's kind of like, what are you doing? Just don't even address this stuff or don't even get involved. He's a nutty character, but when he's great host. He's a great host.
Yeah, super, super friendly guy. When I was like 19 or something like that, I ran into him at the mall in Cleveland. And I don't know if he even really knew who I was, but he could just tell from how I was dressed that I was like in hardcore or something like that. And he was there with one of the guys from Warzone because they were playing that night. And he was like, oh, you want to eat lunch with us? And I was like, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
So...
yeah, that's the kind of stuff you do, definitely.
Yeah, so I think the guy's name was Todd from Warzone, maybe. I don't remember.
Oh, like a darker guy or no?
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, yeah, Todd Hamilton.
Yeah, that was the guy.
Yep.
And so I ate at Taco Bell with Chubby and Todd from Warzone. It was cool. So I have nothing bad to say about him personally. Again, I don't endorse everything he has said or done, but he was always cool to me.
Yeah, I was thinking about having him on a few times, but I don't want him to get himself in trouble.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, I don't care what people think to me. That a friend, my friend is my friend. You know, like I'm not going to hide it.
But yeah,
I don't want to see him get himself in trouble. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, Tony, for listening, thank you for inviting me to lunch. That was cool. I still remember it 20 some years later.
See that, Chubbs? You say everybody hates you. See, somebody remembers a nice thing about you.
No, everybody. Everybody likes him, you know, I think. You just kind of, yeah, everyone likes him. They're just like, oh, why did you say that?
Yeah, yeah, he's a wild dude. Almost like the Midwestern way. It's like this, it's like an antagonist kind of, it's like they're hardcore, but they're punk in the sense of like,
yes,
I want to shock somebody. I want to really fuck somebody's head up. Like, what can I do?
I appreciate that. Like, I appreciate that. I had the P.O. box next to DeWitt, and so I'd run into him at the post office sometimes. I don't think he really knew who I was exactly either, but I was around those guys quite a bit. And, you know, not always positive interactions. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
But I appreciate that they were, like you said, is very punk, like just antagonizing the world. I can appreciate it.
Yeah. Now with DeWitt, I don't like that motherfucker. I put that out there. People,
I don't know him. He was always a little bit rude to me, but I don't know him personally.
Yeah, he's like an ego guy, you know, cocky, arrogant ego, and he shouldn't really be like that. Chubbs is like I said, he's kind. He'll treat everybody nice, but he just verbally like, why are you going there? Why are you saying this? You know. He gets himself into trouble, but yeah.
I tried to, you know, I mean, especially at that time, integrity was a really big deal. So whenever I would run into DeWitt, I would, you know, kind of, and we had some mutual friends. I would try to kind of talk to him, and he just wasn't really having it, probably because I was a dorky little kid or whatever. Which, you know, whatever. But yeah, it didn't leave a good taste in my mouth.
Yeah, I don't like that. The arrogance, you know.
Yeah,
it's like defeats the whole purpose of the scene itself. Like if you're gonna walk around like a rock star, then go try to be one. You know what I mean? Get the fuck out of here.
Well, at the time, you know, it seemed like integrity, you know, in the context of the hardcore scene at that time, you know, kind of seemed like they were. But in hindsight, yeah, it's just another hardcore band.
Yeah, totally. I mean, they did well in hardcore, but we know how that is.
Whatever, yeah, for whatever that's worth.
Yeah. And, yo, I appreciate talking to you. I'm a big listener, digging this stuff, and it's turning me on to a ton of new things and even old stuff. But I wanted to ask you one thing before you go, because you are an expert, okay? And you put me on with the Slipknot rhetoric and how, you know, essential they were. They really did change the game in metal. And I love metal. It's just not really my scene.
Yeah.
But what would you consider the top three most influential metal bands, or let's say important metal bands?
Like ever or?
Ever, from day one until now.
Metal bands, I mean, I would say, Gosh, that's a tough one. But I mean, you have to have Metallica in there, right? Yes,
100%.
You have to have Metallica in there. I would say probably Pantera as well, for kind of creating the groovy sort of style that has become so popular since then. And I would say Meshuggah probably would be number three.
Meshuggah, yes. I hear you mention them a lot. You're a big fan of them.
Not really.
No?
I mean, I appreciate them. I don't listen to their music because it's a little bit too repetitive for me.
Okay.
But I certainly respect them.
Because I saw in the, I think it was the nu metal video you put out, you give them a lot of props for kind of pioneering that style. Am I right in saying that or no?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that style of riffing that fucking absolutely everybody uses now. I mean, in the same way as you remember how everyone ripped off Slayer in the 90s. And, you know, that's how everyone is with Meshuggah now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know how much people know how much they rip off Meshuggah because it's just so like common now.
I got to revisit that. You know, I got to check that out and put it to
listen to their album, Destroy, Erase, Improve, which is from 95, I think. And consider that they were like 21 then, and that was all recorded with no click track to fucking basically live. And listen to how fucking tight and modern that sounds. It is absurd.
That changes things, live and no click track, especially for technical music.
It's like, absurd.
Yeah.
And it is so fucking tight. It is tighter than other people. Like, you can use every studio trick you want. You will not sound as tight as Meshuggah does live. That is how good they are.
That's impressive. Now, you said those three bands, and I always wonder, because in a lot of the videos I hear, I only ever heard you mention this band one time. Maybe I'm wrong, though.
Okay.
But what is Black Sabbath's?
Oh, well, sure. Yeah. I mean, that's totally valid. Yeah. I mean, it's hard to pick just three. I guess, you know, maybe you're right. Maybe it should be Metallica, Black Sabbath, and I mean, Meshuggah really has to be up there. Like, as far as modern metal goes, like, they're definitely the most influential band of the past 20 years. Like, I don't think you could argue that. Black Sabbath. Yeah, you're right. Black Sabbath should probably be in there.
Yeah, I was like, I wonder if this dude, he likes Black Sabbath at all.
I know. I never listened to Black Sabbath. I've never owned a Black Sabbath album. I mean, obviously I'm familiar with them, but I've never owned their album. It was too, I mean, I was already listening to like Sepultura before I really ever heard them. So I was like, this is just slow and boring.
Yeah, I could see that. All right. It's a different kind of thing. Maybe as an adult going back, you might dig them. I don't know, but
like, I can appreciate it. It's just, it's too late. You know what I mean? It's like how I never got into any of the 70s punk stuff. To be like, oh, you got to listen to the Dickies and, you know, Television. And I'm like, this sucks. Like, I want to listen to the Circle Jerks.
Honestly, even the Bad Brains was like that for me. I could never
Me too.
I couldn't get into them. I definitely understand because everybody that I love them.
Yeah.
So I could understand the importance. But it just wasn't.
Totally respect it. I just wouldn't choose to listen to it.
Yeah. And I almost like seeing the little clips from them live rather than playing their songs like from any albums.
Yeah, it is interesting, though, like listening to them. You know, I remember I would hear, Harley Flanagan and stuff talk about how influential they were. And I didn't really get it at the time. But listening to it now, it's like obvious, like all those Cro-Mags riffs are, you know, very, very influenced by Bad Brains. I can hear it crystal clear now.
Yeah, totally. I agree. Well, listen, Finn, I appreciate it. Great convo. And everybody out there, you know, if you're not onto this already, then you get onto it because we're all about music. Anybody that I'd assume that listens to my podcast is all about the music, and a podcast like yours and a YouTube channel and all the stuff you do on the side's super important to it, especially for any heavy or underground music, because, you know, we don't really have outlets and anybody with an actual, you know, voice that gets past our own walls talking about it. So it's great that you're doing this, man. I love it.
I do what I can, and appreciate the support.
All right, my friend, I'll talk to you soon.
Take care.
All right, my friends, that does it for this episode of the podcast. If you made it this far, thank you. Thank you for listening. We sincerely appreciate each and every one of you. If you want to help the show, there's a couple things that you can do. First of all, share it on social media. If you share it, tag us, tag Finn McKenty, that's me, and tag Deanna Chapman, that's a producer. Second thing you can do, if you really, really, really love us and really want to support us, you can support us on Patreon. There's a link to that in the show notes. You can leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you're listening to this, or you can do none of that. And you can just sit at home, think about how awesome this podcast is. That works too. Again, thank you very much to each and every one of you for listening. We sincerely appreciate it, and we'll see you next time.
Hey, this is Aaron from No Simple Road. I'm inviting you to come hang out with Apple, Mel, and I as we talk with the musicians, artists, chefs, authors, and beyond from the world that turns us on. We're reaching into the improvisational music scene, the psychedelic culture, the festival world, and getting to know what makes the people tick that create those scenes. Come join us on the long, strange trip over at No Simple Road.
Welcome to us talking about our podcast for a minute.
What's the name of that podcast?
That's Axe to Grind. And right now you're going to be getting a little taste of it, right down to the shaky microphone and all.
And my name's Bob.
And my name's Patrick. And usually we're joined by Tom.
Tom's the best. Tom has a real grown-up job that requires him to be at work. But we talk about decidedly not so grown-up things like
hardcore music and things that people that like hardcore music tend to like.
So that could be the latest shows, revisiting classic material, talking about the new classics, all the little dorm room nonsense that you imagine from a niche music podcast that you either love, want to love, or hate.
Yeah, imagine all the emotions that you have towards a genre that has impacted your life. And then condense them down to an hour to 2 hours a week.
So triangulate your speakers. Think about jumping off the bed, singing along, dancing like an idiot, and listen to Axe to Grind podcast.